Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Once again, we're pleased to welcome best-selling, multi-award-winning author Robert Crace with his latest thriller, The First Rule, which debuted as number two on the New York Times bestseller list. So, isn't that great? Robert grew up on the Louisiana banks of the Mississippi River in a blue-collar family of oil refinery workers and police officers. He purchased a secondhand paperback of Raymond Chandler's The Little Sister when he was 15.
Got a hot chicken.
So if you want to get your 15-year-old children or grandchildren, whatever, writing, there you go. We've got one copy on hand. Okay. Which inspired his lifelong love of writing, Los Angeles, and the literature of crime fiction. In 1976, where he found writing scripts for major television series such as Hill Street Blues, Cagney and Lacey, and Miami Vice. He was nominated for his work on Hill Street Blues, but is most proud of his four-hour miniseries, Crossfire, a powerful series of Ku Klux Klan's rise to national prominence in the 20s. You can find all this stuff on his great website, too, so it's not hard to find if you just Google. Robert lives in Santa Monica, the Santa Monica Mountains, with his wife, three cats, and almost as many books as the TC has. Tonight we'll get a glimpse of the latest intrigue of Joe Pike and Elvis Cole. So let's welcome him and get going.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I appreciate it. I'm just curious, how many of you guys get my newsletter?
Oh, yeah, my people. Thank you. Those of you who don't, as Pat said, I have a website, and people write to me through the website, and I get a lot of fan mail, which I love getting. And so when I was preparing to come out on this tour, I thought I might... It might be fun for me to bring along some of the emails that I've collected over the years and kind of share, give you a glimpse into what it's like to be me. So, now, you're not going to believe these are real, but they are. Here we go. Let's... Subject, Robert Crace. Message, Dear Robert Crace, you are a god. That's my favorite reader. Not everyone agrees. Among my many, many failings, I guess, is the fact that I'm a product of the Louisiana public education system, and I'm grammatically challenged. Subject, bring, take. You already know, don't you? Yeah. Subject, bring, take. You seem not to understand the proper use of bring and take. You use bring when you should be using take. In fact, I cannot recall your ever using take. This is a glaring mistake that is unacceptable from a published writer. Grammar Nazi. Subject, take and bring. Just a quick note, you use bring for take, period. At least it was quick. That was it. You use bring for take. Okay. Subject, bring and take. I am a devoted fan, having read 11 of your books so far. My only bone of contention is your misuse of bring and take. There were 11 such mistakes in The Monkey's Raincoat. I'm currently reading The Forgotten Man, and so far, I found 5 more. Followed quickly by, subject, brought instead of take. There's one small thing that bugs me about your work. I just finished reading The Forgotten Man. You use bring for take, or take for bring, on pages 37, 49, 56, 70, 91, 126, 186, 223, 231, 250, 263, 161, and 251. It is grating. Subject, Robert Crace's grammar. I've read most of your books and I'm wondering why nobody, editors, friends, yourself, has corrected your erroneous use of bring instead of take. The same error occurs in every book. This casts an air of ignorance. Another grammar Nazi. One of the best things about being me is that people name their pets after me. Subject, picture of my dog, Crace. Dear Mr. Crace, here is a picture of my dog, Crace, named after you. And they included a photograph of their dog, Crace, named after me. Now, you really won't be able to see it, I guess, but there's Crace, a lovely yellow lab decked out in festive Christmas attire. A few weeks later, I received another letter. Dear Mr. Crace, here's a picture of my dog, Crace, with Rick Springfield. And here is the dog, Crace, named after me, with Rick Springfield, who seems to be in fear of his life. Followed, a few months later, by, Dear Mr. Crace, here's a picture of my dog, Crace, with Olivia Newton-John. And there's poor Olivia Newton-John, also in fear of her life. Now, I kind of think this is cute and like it, except that you just know that Olivia Newton-John's out there thinking, I put this woman up to it. People also let their animals use my books for beds. Subject, my cat Keppel sleeping on your book. Dear Mr. Crace, here is a picture of my cat Keppel sleeping on your book. And there's Keppel the cat sleeping on my book. At least my books are good for something. Sometimes the email I get disturbs me. Subject, Elvis Cole's grooming. I've read this letter 62 times. It still freaks me out. Dear Mr. Crace, I'm concerned about Elvis Cole. I dreamed last night that he hired me as an assistant, and one of my duties was doing his laundry, in which I found undies with skid marks. Now, they actually typed that up and sent it to me. Sometimes they'll break your heart. Subject, Mom. Dear Mr. Crace, I don't know whether you remember, but some time ago, you did me a service. My mother had ALS, and you broke your general rule about autographing books through the mail to sign a hardcover for her. She was absolutely delighted, so thoroughly tickled she crowed about it to all her friends. It gave her enormous pleasure. Well, Mom passed yesterday, still in love with you and your work. While she was bedridden, I read to her Elvis and Joe's most recent adventure, and it gave her even more pleasure. Anyhow, I thought you'd want to know that her troubles are over. Thank you so much. It meant the world to both of us. And every once in a while, a guy like me gets reminded that there's some value to this beyond just typing. So it's pretty cool to get letters like that. But now on to the book. This is my 16th book. It's the 13th in the Elvis Cole series, even though Joe Pike is the main character. The arrows aren't up here, right? They're somewhere else. You're going to be given red arrows. Somewhere. Where are they? Are they up here? Okay, well, there's red arrows. If you've read the book, and clearly you folks have, you know, that's all right, Pat. I just wanted to show them, but they're going to see. They know. They've read the books. Joe is a very visual character. You know, there's an iconic imagery to him. He's the guy who wears sunglasses 24/7. He's the guy who always has the sleeveless sweatshirts with red arrows inked onto his the outside of his deltoids. And those arrows, I think, more than anything else, truly suggest his nature. That nature, you know, always move forward, never back up, don't give ground. You know, if you read the books, The Watchman, L.A. Requiem, the others, you know that early on, Joe had to make choices and develop a philosophy to help himself survive. That's the philosophy he developed, so that later when he was a young combat Marine, he had the arrows inked on, so he never forgot. Always move forward. That's how you survive. You drive through the threat, drive through the danger. You control your environment. Also, you read the books, and you know that in the last few books, I've really been trying to explore why these guys are who they are, how they came to be Elvis Cole and Joe Pike, how their character and nature was forged. And I really wanted to do that in this book, because as I thought about Joe, I thought, you know, a guy who's made these difficult choices, has chosen to live his life this way, it's been tough. I can't imagine that this is really an easy way for someone to live. And I thought that perhaps on some level, though, you know, Joe is not a Dr. Phil kind of guy. You know, he's not going to sit there and express to you and open himself up. But I thought that in his own way, internally, he probably deals with the sacrifices he's made from time to time. He probably recognizes that there are holes or absences in his heart that maybe, if his choices had been otherwise, if his life had been otherwise, those empty places would be filled. Back to the arrows. The way I imagine Elvis Cole's Los Angeles, there is only one Joe Pike, of course, and there's only one set of arrows, Joe's arrows. So anyone who knew him on LAPD, anyone who's bumped into him or seen him over the years, they see those red arrows. They think Pike. No one else has them. Okay, let's step to the side and think about his life. There's Joe Pike, young combat Marine. After he gets out of the Marines, he becomes an LAPD officer. That doesn't work out for him. After a few years as an LAPD officer, he resigns. And then he does what probably he's better at than anyone else. He fights. He becomes a professional soldier, mercenary, working for private military contractors around the world. Africa, you know, I related a little bit of that in The Watchman. But, you know, he's in Africa, he's in Asia, South America, the Middle East. And he did that for several years until he reached that point where I guess he retired to become Elvis Cole's full-time friend. But while he was a mercenary, I figured, hey, here's Joe with his maturity, with his grounding, with his skill set. He likely was a group leader, and he had other young professional soldiers under him, like a team, group, unit. And I would bet that those younger guys, they really looked up to him, revered him, saw him as a mentor. And I think it went the other way, too, because Joe would only work with the very best guys. So I thought a character named Frank Meyer. So here's Frank, who was in Joe's group, and Joe was his mentor. And Joe loved this kid. And this kid, he just looked up to Frank as an older brother, father figure. One day, Frank meets a girl, falls in love. One thing leads to another. She becomes pregnant. When she tells Frank, he immediately asks her to marry him because he is ecstatic. He can't think. He's so in love with her, he can't think of anything better than spending the rest of his life with this woman, raising a family, the whole, 2.4, all of it. But he gets the surprise of his life because rather than say yes, she says, "Are you kidding? Not on your life. I mean, look at you. Look at this crazy, dangerous thing you do. You're gone for weeks and months at a time. There's no way I'm going to expose this baby to that. There's no way I'm going to put myself in this kind of risk. If you truly want to share my life and this child's life, you're going to have to turn your back on all that stuff. Shut the door on it. Walk away. Never have anything to do with these crazy people ever again. You're going to have to be normal." Well, Frank, upset and confused, he runs back to the guys and he tells the guys about all this, the baby and what this girl Cindy has said to him. And all the guys being young, tough guys, they say what young, tough guys say. They're all going, "Are you kidding? I mean, you're not even married to this girl yet. Look how she's busting your chops. Drop her, man. Tell her to get off the bus. I mean, come on. There are plenty of girls out there. You don't need this grief." But when he tells Joe doesn't have that reaction. Joe says, "Do you love this girl?" He says, God, yes, I'm totally, I want to marry her. I want to spend the rest of my life with her." And Joe says to him, "Well, if that's really your dream, if that's the dream you want for yourself, then do what she wants. Leave us behind, walk away. Build that life with her." And that's what Frank did. Resigned from the PMC, and for 10 years, he hasn't seen nor heard from any of those guys. Turned his back on it all. And Joe Pike and the other guys, they've not seen nor heard from Frank Meyer in 10 years. And in fact, Frank and Cindy get married. They have two little boys. The boys start to grow. Frank creates a normal business, importing fabrics and things that he resells to American stores. It is, in fact, the perfect life that Frank always imagined until one night into his nice new home in Los Angeles, a home invasion crew kicks down the front door, comes in, and murders all of them. Frank, Cindy, the little boys, the nanny, guns them all down, all of them. The next day, the scene is swarming with LAPD, coroner's office people, SID people. And when the investigating detectives come in there, they have seen this thing before, because Frank isn't the first time this home invasion crew is hit. It's actually the seventh time. They've hit six other houses before, and the cops have no clue as to who is doing this. The only thing they know is this. The first six houses, those sets of victims, each and every one of them, were all somehow involved in crime. They were either drug dealers, money launderers, fences, something. They were someone who would have a large quantity of cash in the house. And that's been perceived to be the motive for the murders and the robberies. So now those cops, even though Frank Meyer appears to be a normal everyday businessman with a normal everyday family, now the cops are wondering, well, what was Frank involved in? But now in Frank's house, for the first time, the cops get a clue. They get a lead that's going to bring them to someone they can ask about Frank's history and involvement. Because when they're in the house and they're examining Frank's body, they see something they only seen one other place. Frank has two red arrows tattooed on the outside of his arms, just like Joe Pike. So, of course, they look up Pike. Remember, Pike hasn't seen Frank in 10 years. And they drop these two bombs on him. What criminal activity was your buddy Frank Meyer involved in? And, hey, by the way, we got to you because he's got your arrows on. Is that some kind of mercenary thing you guys all did? Well, Pike's a little taken aback because the last time he saw Frank Meyer, Frank had no tattoos. So he wonders about that. When and why? What does that mean? And as far as this criminal stuff, there's no way. Because the Frank Meyer that Joe knew never, ever would have gotten involved in crime. But it's been 10 years, and now Joe's curious. So when the cops leave him, Joe beelines over to the crime scene. not supposed to be there, but his buddy John Chen, turns out he's one of the SID investigators there. John sneaks him in for a little quickie exam of the area. Pike leaves. He calls John Stone. If you read The Watchmen, you'll be familiar with the John Stone character, who was also a former mercenary. And he tells him about Frank, and then John sets about trying to find that, you know, make inquiries, trying to find out, well, was Frank involved with someone? Was he perhaps involved in some criminal element that we ran into in the old mercenary days? So John's out there making some calls. Into that first day, Joe, who's been brooding about this ever since he heard about it, goes back to Frank's house. Now it's late. Now it's dark. It's still an active crime scene, so it's guarded by the police. It's dark. Joe breaks in. He breaks in because he wants to see what Frank's was like. Frank's life was like. I'm going to read two brief excerpts for what happens that night when Joe's in Frank's house to give you an idea of what Joe's dealing with here. Joe slips in. Again, he's got a little tiny flashlight. He's looking around. This is what he finds. The heart-shaped stain where Cindy Meyer and her younger son died was a darker smudge on the dark floor, one murky red over another. Pike studied it for a moment, but Pike wasn't looking for clues. He was looking for Frank. Pike circled the family room, the dining room, and the kitchen, moving as silent as smoke. He noted the furniture, toys, and magazines as if each was a page in the book of the family's life, helping to build their story. A hall led to the master bedroom, which was large and spacious. Photographs of the kids and Frank and Cindy dotted the walls like memories captured in time. An antique desk sat opposite a king-size bed with a padded headboard, a plaque on the desk reading Empress of the World, Cindy's desk, where she had probably paid bills or helped with the business. Pike played his flashlight over Cindy's desk and saw more snapshots. Frank and the kids, an older couple who might have been Cindy's parents. And then Pike found the picture he was looking for. He had not known he was searching for it, but felt a sense of completion when he saw it. The snapshot showed Frank in a swimming pool with one of the boys. Frank had heaved his son in the air amid a geyser of water, both of them laughing, Frank's arms extended. This picture was the only photograph of all the photos that showed the blocky red arrows tattooed onto his deltoids, pointing forward, just as the arrows on Pike's delts pointed forward. Identical. Pike studied the picture for a long while before he returned it to the desk and left the bedroom. Pike did not have a family, so he had no pictures of family on the walls, and he did not keep pictures of his friends. Pike's life had led to blank walls, and now he wondered for the first time if his walls would ever be filled. Pike had to see those red arrows. He had to see his old friend Frank with those red arrows, and now I think more than ever he's wondering what it meant for Frank to do that. He continues through the house, for the first time seeing the little boys, seeing pictures of what Frank's life must have been like, feeling what that house was like when living people were in it, laughing and doing what people do. He finds his way down to Frank's home office at the front of the house. Big open picture window. The drapes are pulled back because of the way that's the way the police left it. It's all in darkness. Pike sits at Frank's desk. He's feeling it, knowing his friend sat there, trying to feel his friend in that chair. While he's there at the desk, his cell phone rings. It's John Stone. Now, John doesn't know that Pike's at Frank's house. John's been out making his inquiries, and now he has some information that he wants to relate. So he calls Pike to fill him in. As they're talking, this happens. Stone was giving Pike the address when light exploded into the office, so bright the walls and furniture were white with glare. Pike, still in the chair with his back to the window, did not move. A patrol car was checking the house. Pike said, "Shh." "What's wrong?" An enormous blue shadow crossed the office wall as if someone had moved in front of the light. Pike heard faint radio calls and listened for approaching footsteps. Stone's tiny voice came from the phone. "You sound weird, man. Where are you?" Pike whispered, as still as a fish at the bottom of a pond. "Franks, the police are outside."
"You break in?"
"Shh." The light swung away, moving to another part of the house like an animal tracking a scent. John said, "What the hell are you doing at Frank's?" "I wanted to see what his life was like."
"You're a strange cat, Pike. I mean, really."
The light outside snapped off. The yard plunged into darkness and the patrol car rolled on. Pike said, "Okay. Hey, Joe, is it nice?" "What?" "Frank's house. Does he have a nice place?"
"Yes."
"Fancy?"
"Not like you mean. It's a good family home."
Pike heard Stone swallow, heard the glass tink the phone. "You think it's true Frank went bad?"
"Chen thinks the people who did this got the wrong house."
"Like what? They got confused about which house they wanted to rob?"
"It happens."
"What do you think?"
"Doesn't matter to me if they got it wrong."
No, it surely doesn't." Stone made a deep sigh. Pike thought it might have been a sob, but then Stone had another sip of whatever he was sipping and went on. "Assholes like this. They go in these houses, right house, wrong house, murder people like they were nothing, probably sleep like a baby after it's over. How many times have they done this?"
"Frank was a 7.
"You see? This is my point. 6 times they got away clean, murdered some poor bastard, and there have been no consequences. Hence, these people do not fear the dead. They love the dead, Joe, because the dead, and I apologize if my assessment here seems harsh, but the dead have not been effective when it comes to consequence and retribution."
Pike said, "What are you drinking?"
"I'm drinking scotch in honor of our friend Frank.
I would rather rip off a 21-gun salute out in the backyard, but my neighbors prefer the drinking."
"What was that I said?" "Consequence and retribution."
"Oh, right."
John Stone was grieving, so Pike let him.
"But then they hit Frank the Tank. Them not knowing he was Frank the Tank, them thinking he was just another ordinary dead guy without recourse to consequence. So dig this. And this is my favorite part. Those guys are somewhere right now. Shooting up, robbing, whatever. They are somewhere right now. And they do not know a shitstorm is on the horizon. And it's coming for them."
Pike said, "John, do you have photographs on your walls?"
"What, like naked chicks?"
"Pictures of your family and friends."
"Oh, hell yeah. I take pictures of everything, man. I got pictures of human heads. Why?"
"No reason. Get some sleep."
"I want in on this, bro. I mean it. Whatever. I want in."
"Get some sleep, John."
"Ah, hell with it, Joe. Hey, Joe, you still there?"
"What?" Stone was silent for so long, Pike thought he had fallen asleep, but then he spoke. "None of us had families. You never married. Lonnie, Colin, not them either. Wallace got divorced. I've been married 6 damn times, man. What does that tell you? None of us had kids." Pike didn't know what to say, but maybe Stone voiced it for him, soft and hoarse from the booze. "I really wanted Frank to make it. Not just for him, either." Pike shut his phone. He sat in Frank's office for almost an hour, alone with himself in the silence, then walked back along the hall to Cindy's desk.
He took the framed picture of Frank in the pool, the one showing the red arrows, tucked it into his pocket, then let himself out and drove home for the night. That provides Joe's motivation for everything that's going to happen after. You don't want to be on the receiving end. Anyway, thank you all for coming tonight. I truly, truly do appreciate it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.